Buddhist Summer School, Wednesday, 14th August, 1985. Venerable lady and fellow students and wayfarers of the Dharma. In the passage which I read at the close of our meeting yesterday, there was this sentence: to wing the uncharted flight in the trackless open. I said yesterday that sati, culminating in samasati, is the pure meditative state. That is, mindfulness, what started as mindfulness, has become meditation. Whereas sati is concentrated attention upon any one object of observation, samasati is all-inclusively sensitive to the total environment. This is samadhi, which is an all-inclusive awareness, a permanent, still, and silent mindfulness, different from sati in that there is no exclusiveness here. In sati, there is duality. You, the observing subject, the self, are paying bare attention to the observed object, the not-self. If the object happens to be your own thought process, your own citta, the mental state or general consciousness, the observed is yourself, the observer. In other words, in this situation, the subject is the object and the object is the subject. But subject and object are still apart, for there is a gap between them, although they are related to each other by the bridge of observation. When the intensity of attentiveness overtops the critical point, vijnana undergoes a transmutation. In the twinkling of an eye, isolative, separative self-consciousness, vijnana, is changed into holistic consciousness. Vijnanam anidassanam anantam sabbato bhavam. Consciousness, which is characterless, which is infinite, beginningless and endless, everywhere shining. The gap between the observer and the observed, that is, duality, vanishes. And then self and not self are simply the one total reality. Holistic consciousness is the fully awakened state, functioning in terms of unitary wholeness. And this is samadhi. Whereas in sati there is observation of an other, in samadhi there is no otherness. There is only whole being. Then you are no longer exclusively John Smith or Mary Brown, for you have re-established your integral unity with the totality. That is the purpose also of yoga in the full sense. It's the restoration of one's separate self to the unitary totality. The one holy being, sat, one also in mind and consciousness, chit, And in this unitarily whole state, there is bliss, ananda. Thus, we can begin to understand the meaning of sat chit ananda. All knowingness, insight, and pure intelligence are rooted in holistic consciousness, that awakened state which is the light of transcendence. We must remember that when sati culminates in samadhi, it is not you or I, separate mortals, who have attained or achieved anything. You or I have only cleansed our existential being and made it a fit vehicle for holistic consciousness, just as the psychophysical organism is a fit vehicle for vijnana, isolative, separative consciousness. It is transcendence which realizes its own transcendence, manifested as the perfect human through you as the means, as the lighting up point in space-time. In such holistic consciousness, you or I experience deathlessness, immortality, whilst this mortal organism is still alive. Thus does origin, primordial, undifferentiated creative energy, come round full circle into its own self as wholly awakened consciousness, not vijnana but holistic. Whereas the becoming process, manifestation, started as an involution into increasing concretization of energy as matter, with the consequent limiting and imprisoning of consciousness as ignorance and suffering, avidya and dukkha, it proceeds, after passing its nadir, as an evolution which spells release from bondage and culminates in enlightenment, freedom and bliss, sambodhi, vimokha and ananda. Such is the peak point for the human. And when a human has realized that, he has fulfilled the supreme purpose of his individual existence as such. Thereafter, he can enter into and remain in the meditative state whenever and for as long as he decides to stay meditating. Seemingly a timeless instant to holistic consciousness, but even as long as a week in time to vijnanic consciousness. Meditation is creative action in eternity. Our task ends when we enter the meditative state desirelessly. In this state, there is no isolated you or me, for what was you or me is now only egoless being, and the perception of anatta in its true meaning has become a realized fact. There is transcendence alone. Its context is the infinite eternal. My entry into the meditative state has not destroyed me, the existential mortal. For when I emerge out of the experiencing of immortality and return to ordinary sense and brain activity and vijnanic functioning, I continue to live as a self-conscious individual, the same entity previously known in the world by my name. But there is one important difference. Transcendence and the holistic consciousness is now the permanent and peaceful background of my whole living process, and the whole of the Paticchasamuppada no longer operates for me as a human inhabitant of this world, because all ill, dukkha, is completely ended. And remember that the whole of the Paticchasamuppada is concerned with the thought process, the movement of the vijnanic stream. I, who am still alive now, am simply the nama rupa vijnana complex, the existential being. We can never know in our manner of knowing by the brain the nature of creative action in eternity. All that we can know is confined within the context of the finite and temporal, that is, as far as the body, whilst we are functioning in the body, can know. In the supreme meditative state that has undergone the transformation by which you are holistically consciousness, you are holistically conscious in terms of infinity and eternity. And that means that all that comes within the sphere of space and time is totally transcended. There is no such thing as past, present or future in that holistic consciousness. It is the absolute all, so to say. There is no here and there, no progress, no growth, no movement, nothing like that in terms of space, which exists in terms of space in the holistic consciousness. And that is infinity, immeasurability, indescribability. It is our present consciousness is restricted to space and time, to motion, matter and manifestation, to the measurable. None of these categories apply to the context of the infinite eternal, which is non-descript, but is open to and is experienceable in holistic consciousness. To us, this consciousness and its context is silence, a vibrant quiescence, a live stillness. When I, the existential being, want to act, I have first to plan, to think out that action which is specific and separate from totality. The plan and the act merely exist. And remember, the meaning of existence is a standing out of, ex sistere, to stand out of. All manifestation stands out of the ultimate origin, whatever that may be, you see. And therefore, when that produces all that we see in the cosmos, including ourselves, is something which is limited and sorrowful. One of the meanings of the word dukkha is far from the infinite. That is one of its meanings. Since whatever exists has to come into existence, it has to be born. Inevitably, it dies in due time. If and when I am selfless, desireless, all tanha extirpated, I am transcendentally inactive, which is by no means the same thing as inaction in our present world as such. I am transcendentally inactive, unmoving, devoid of a self-center. Then the creative action in eternity by transcendence takes place, as long as I remain in the pure meditative state. In this connection, let us note a wonderfully significant statement in the Zarathustrian scriptures. In Yasna 19, it is said that the pronouncement of the creative word, the Ahuna Vairya, by the Supreme Being, Ahura Mazda, creates the cosmos in perfection and presumably maintains it by repeating the word. For in verse 15 it is said, owing to a pause in repeating the Ahuna Vairya, evil originates. It's an extraordinary teaching. That means that insofar as we at any time are out of the pure meditative state, there is always the possibility of evil. Now, if in a single moment of forgetfulness or of slackening in diligence, our mindfulness were to falter, an ill state of mind can arise. We have the saying, the devil hath work for idle hands. Much more true is this for the idle mind. Since creative action is selfless and desireless, no karmic bondage is engendered thereby. No dukkha is produced. But when action is not creative, then a karmic bond is forged. Even if by worldly standards it is good action, the merit produced has to be worked out, thus postponing liberation. This does not mean that one should refrain from good action. Far from it. For in due time we learn to renounce that merit for ourselves and relinquish it as a gift to the world. At best, action which is not creative can only be procreative, biologically or culturally. Just a word of explanation there. The difference between creation and procreation. Creation is in the immediate now, the eternal now, and it is absolutely new. That is true creation. It is a creative renewal which constantly goes on by the action in eternity. Procreation, biologically or culturally, science, art, philosophy and all the rest of it, you see, is something which is produced true to type. The type already exists. It has a history from the past and into the present and will continue into the future. But there is no past, present and future where eternity is concerned. And where this transcendent creative activity is concerned, it takes place, both time and space are completely out. At best, action... Oh, sorry, I have read that. It was said a few moments ago that the context of the infinite eternal is nondescript, and that we can never know, in our manner of knowing, the nature of creative action in eternity. This means that unlike all action in the dualistic, vijnanic context of space-time, which has shape and form, which is controllable and alterable, measurable and comparable, etc., because of duality, action in eternity transcending all duality is none of these things. But it may, just may, be understood in terms expressing integrated wholeness, such as the amoral, beyond good and evil, irrational, the integration of the rational and irrational. Remember that it is we who set up the duality of rational and irrational. What we like, what we can be interested in and so forth, we will call rational. And what we dislike or what seems absurd to us, we call the irrational. But the supreme creative energy is beyond all these things, and being beyond all these things, in the moment of the pause, they split up. Out comes duality. Illogical, the integration of the logical and illogical. These terms may gently stir the innermost recesses of the perceptive mind so that panya or buddhi, that is unerring insight into truth, may light up momentarily with a lightning flash of transcendence. Is it not deeply significant that the Buddha himself, a super-rational being, repeatedly says in the Brahmajala Sutta at least 10 or 11 times, because there are other matters, the word is Dhamma, deep, hard to understand, tranquilizing, sweet, not to be grasped by mere logic. Atakavat vachara. Not to be grasped by mere logic. All scientists should take note of that. Subtle, comprehensible by the wise, which the Tathagata has set forth, having realized them himself. Not to be grasped by mere logic, but comprehensible by the wise. The wise one is one who has transcended the duality, and in that transcendence there is only unitary wholeness operating. In the timeless and spaceless silence of the mind, free of disturbance by discursive thought or speech, the wise and holy one, meditating, can comprehend creative action in eternity. You and I are like passing transient thoughts in the pure mind of transcendence. Each thought is the logos, the word which creates. In the Trismegistic writings, it is said that all Father mind, being life and light, brought forth man co-equal to himself, with whom he fell in love as being his own child, for he was beautiful beyond compare. Interesting that the point brought out in those writings is beautiful. Remember Plato's three ideas: goodness, truth, and beauty, because in perfect manifestation the fulfillment is beauty. He was the image, that is the living likeness. I don't like the use of the word image either in the Trismegistic writings or in the first chapter of Genesis. Let us make man in our own image. An image is a mechanical something, and make is a bad word. I prefer to translate that 25th chapter, 25th verse, by saying, let us create man in our own living likeness. Of his sire. In the heart of religion, it is written, page 78, man is transcendence thinking, not discursive talking, not form making. Man, male, female, is the thought, the living likeness of transcendence. It is interesting to note how the Trismegistic writings, which are in Egyptian wisdom in Hellenistic garb, speak of the creative source as All Father Mind. And in the Zarathustrian Yasna 19 verses 12 and 13, it is said that Ahura Mazda, the Lord Wisdom, that's the literal meaning of the term, is prior to his creations, of which the first is mind. The Zarathustrian devotee at his prayers acknowledges that the Ahuna Vairya, the creative word, from the very beginning is mind, and recognizes it, that is the mind, as the heavenly Lord of actions. So I come back to the statement made earlier that meditation in its supreme sense, in its actuality, is creative action in eternity, thus indicating our divine potentiality and our true human status. The word human means happy creator. Now, prescribed modes of meditation are largely verbal rituals. To a considerable extent, they condition the brain, which does not lead one to that unshakable freedom of mind, which is the goal, the pith, the culmination of the Brahma-faring, as the Buddha said to the Brahman Pingalakocha in the Chula Saropama Sutta, and also to a group of monks on Mount Vulture Peak near Rajagaha in the Mahasaropama Sutta. Various religious ceremonials are also verbal rituals. These and prescribed meditation systems are effective only if, with concentrated attention, you can become fully and clearly conscious of the meaning, the living truth embodied in those words. There is a very interesting Upanishad called the Tarasara Upanishad, and I think also the Narayana Upanishad, where this is said, that the great mantra, the magic spell, is Om Namo Narayanaya. And then it's Yajnavalkya's teaching, and he was called the Prince of Yogis. He proceeds to say that each syllable, there are eight syllables there, Om Namo Narayanaya, eight syllables. Each syllable calls forth Brahma, Vishnu, Shiva, and various other powers and faculties. Now, what does that mean? It doesn't mean that if I say Om, up will come Brahma, like you rub Aladdin's lamp and down comes the genie. What says my master? It's not that. It means that your attentiveness is so perfect that it touches the transcendental aspect of the creative energy, which is represented in the word Brahma. The na and the mo similarly conjure up, provided you can attend as intensely as that. That is the point. This is where the development of the power of concentrated attention through mindfulness comes in. It is that which leads to and culminates in the pure meditation, the samadhi. So now, when I have, by saying this, I am not suggesting for a moment to chuck away all your meditative practice and so on. That is the start. You can't avoid it, you see. But as your power of attention and concentration increases, then the transcendental counterpart of what we here have as words, the real living meaning underlying those words, comes alive. But if you find that ceremonies and rituals have a genuinely inspiring and calming effect on you, and you are not indulging in an emotional religious pastime, do not discard them. The infant must needs crawl on all fours ere he can walk or run, and the old man needs a walking stick. Let there be understanding and all-embracing compassion always. The Buddha, however, pointed out that rituals and ceremonies have no efficiency where the treading of the path is concerned. That treading needs constant application and plasticity of mind. It is necessary at times to make a change when change promotes progress. Entering the pure meditative state means that you have made an end of time whilst your psychophysical organism is still alive. That is why I have said in the book on Zarathustra that deathlessness, immortality is experienced here now in the timeless ecstasy of silent meditation. Please note, ecstasy, not ecstasy. Ecstasy means being beside yourself. Ecstasy means going within to that peace that passes all understanding. It's utterly quiet. It's utterly silent. Ecstasy is something quite different. The frenzy of the pop singers, for instance, can be ecstatic. The word time, like the word space, stands for your mode of awareness of the living process of that which is actually present. Constituted as we are, vijnanic awareness is characterized by constant successiveness. We are aware of each thought or mood or act or event as following upon the previous act or mood. Each state of mind or each event is dualistic, like the diastole, the expansion, and the systole, the contraction of the heart, or the in-breath and out-breath of our breathing. The dualistic nature of vijnanic functioning we call beginning-ending or birth-death. And since we associate the I am I consciousness with every beginning or birth and with every ending or death, throughout the single lifespan of the whole organism, we go through an immense number of births and deaths. The separative and isolative I am I consciousness comes into being well after I am born. It is sustained throughout my life by the coordinated activity of all the khandhas from rupa to vijnana, composing the organism, the nama rupa. In deep slumber, the separative and isolative I am I consciousness vanishes. If you apply, those of you who may be interested in the Upanishadic presentation of the four stages, you know, in in Buddhism we have four jhanas, four samapattis. But in the Upanishads they only talk of the jagrata, waking state, the swapna or dreaming state, the what is the word for the dreamless? Sushupti. Thank you. The sushupti state, that is the dreamless slumber state, that is verging right into the pure meditative state. And finally the turiya, the fourth state, which is transcendental. Absolutely transcendental. So now, in deep slumber, the separative I-am-I consciousness vanishes. When the organism dies and disintegrates, all the constituents of the nama-rupa fall apart and are no more. Remember that vedana, sanya, sankhara and vijnana, which constitute nama, have no independent existence of their own in the absence of rupa, a living physical body. You never saw a mind devoid of a body walking down the strand, nor have you ever seen a body devoid of mind walking up the strand. The human organism is a psychophysical organism in the complete sense. Since even in deep sleep the I-am-I consciousness disappears, with the death of the organism, which is the source of that consciousness, it disappears completely, for the forces which kept it going have disintegrated. It seems to me that the real meaning of reincarnation or rebirth, or if you like some big words, transmigration, metempsychosis, metensomatosis or palingenesis, rebirth or reincarnation is the whole series of births and deaths associated with my I am I consciousness during the lifetime of the single organism that bears my name. The belief in rebirth as being the repeated manifestations of a single identifiable entity through a succession of different organisms in time and space seems to me to be an illusory misconception projected by the dualistically functioning mind, driven by the lust for the survival and continuity of the isolated ego, which is a slave to the inordinate greed for perpetual delight in a mythical, blissful hereafter. One asks, what is there then for me by living the holy life? Absolutely nothing whatsoever worldly. When we can really see that there is nothing for oneself at all, then there is the beginning of the selfless state. It is transcendence, the unitary whole, which undergoes all this. The entire cosmos is the body of that, is the unitarily whole body of that primordial creative energy. And it manifests in innumerable different ways. And there are types of existence. Generally speaking, the mineral, the plant, the animal, the human, and so on. Different types of existence. And each type comes to fruition when it has become perfectly pure and perfect. And that means that transcendence has displayed its transcendence through the perfect rose, the perfect oak, the perfect lion, the perfect mosquito, and each fulfills its own proper function, and the perfect human. So you see, the Samma Sambuddha, or a Christ, or a Zarathustra, or a Krishna, they represent the first fruits of humanity. the purpose of our existence, the main purpose, is just that. There are other little purposes too. But listen to the Buddha's words some days after the enlightenment, spoken at the foot of the Muchalinda tree. This comes in the Mahavagga, the first few pages. Happy his solitude who, glad at heart, hath Dhamma learned and doth the vision see. Happy is that benignity towards the world which on no creature worketh harm. Happy the absence of all lust, the ascent past and beyond the needs of sense desires. He who doth crush, I don't like the word crush there, I would prefer to say transmutes. He who doth crush the great I am conceit, meaning I am a separate self, something separate from the totality. This, truly this, is happiness supreme. What more or better need one ask? All that is for you, for me. And it is our divine potentiality. Crushing the great I am conceit does not mean the destruction of the dualistically functioning vijnana, for isolated self-consciousness is indispensable for the ordinary routine of material life. Crossing the street safely, cutting a slice of bread without cutting your finger, etc., etc. But it does mean disentangling oneself from all the limitations and evils wrought by it. When transcended, vijnana is transmuted into vijnanam anidasanam anantam sabbato pabam. That great Upanishadic teacher, Yajnavalkya, who was called the Prince of Yogis, tells his wife, Maitreya, after death, there is no discriminative, separative consciousness. Maitreya is bewildered because she feels that if she lives the pure life, she will enjoy some specific heavenly reward. So she is bewildered. Yajnavalkya explains that the Atma, absolute consciousness, is the unitarily whole, all-inclusive consciousness. How can that be made an object of perception? We all know that the eye cannot see itself, or the ear hear itself. In holistic consciousness, otherness, separation, conflict, sorrow, imperfection have all disappeared. How can you know the knower? The creative action in eternity by transcendence uses you in the meditative state to uphold, nourish, and manifest Dhamma through the universal living process. And to persuade, for transcendence never compels the cosmos to grow healthily and happily towards its transcendental fruition. Those of you who are interested in yoga, note carefully the different angas, the factors which make up the whole of yoga. You start with the yamas and the niyamas, the purification of the psyche, the asanas and the pranayama, the purification and perfection of the body, to be a fit instrument to stand the incredible voltage of transcendent energy. And then comes the real yoga. Pratyahara, freedom from all attachment and aversion, where our ordinary organic life is concerned. Then dharana, upholding. Upholding what? the eternal law which is embodied throughout the cosmos. And then from dharana you come to dhyana, the attentiveness which culminates in the pure meditative state. And the last stage is samadhi. Samadhi, the supreme togetherness, the unitary wholeness, the final oneness of all things. It can do so because the realm of the infinite eternal is the realm of supreme silence, and you in the meditative state are also completely silent, still, undisturbed and undisturbing. The complete contrast to the realm of vijnana, which is in endless turmoil. In true meditation, you touch nirvana with the body. Now, I'm using the word nirvana here in the usual mistaken meaning of a wonderful, blissful state, happy-go-lucky state. Nirvana means the extinction of all lust, hate, delusion. But having produced nirvana by living the religious life, you will find that you yourself are in this ineffable, peaceful, blissful state. So nirvana means hard work. You will never enter nirvana. You have to perform nirvana, extinguish this lust, hate and delusion. And then your natural state will spontaneously be this utterly peaceful, blissful state. You can't avoid it, in fact. I think the other day I said that all your senses will become cords of communion. The mistake made by so many religious disciplines arises out of decrying the senses and so forth. Far from it. Most of the world lives senselessly, as we know, and see what happens. So you touch nirvana with the body. You experience the sublime, unoriginated peace beyond all understanding. And you know the meaning of deathlessness, of immortality, of eternal life. Eternal life does not mean an endless continuation through time. It does not mean that at all. In such transcendental fruition, the consciousness of you or me as isolated, separate entities completely disappears, like raindrops which lose their separate identity by falling into and becoming one with the ocean. You and I are one in transcendence, no separate you or I. Perhaps this may help us to understand the words of Jesus' prayer in St. John's Gospel, chapter 17, verse 5. And now, O Father, glorify thou me with the glory I had with thee before the world was. Before the world was. That is, before the rolling out of samsara, the becoming process of manifestation, and therefore in the womb of origin, before the first stir of the primordial creative energy in response to the transcendent urge to manifest. Like raindrops into the ocean, or to use a well-known phrase, the dewdrop slips into the shining sea. And let me add, the whole of the shining seed is held in the dewdrop, the bindu of the Upanishads, the shunya of Buddhism. The whole of the shining sea is in the dewdrop. When consciousness is able to function in terms of the infinite and the eternal, there is no small, no large, no long, no short, etc., etc. All that has disappeared. You are conscious in a completely different way, a completely transcendent way. But you never lose your ordinary everyday consciousness of life here as it is. That continues on. Otherwise, we might walk into a moving bus, dent the bus a bit, but what would happen to us? That is how it is in the context of the infinite eternal, the limitless void, which is also the conditioned fullness, integrated. Words, words, one might say. Yes, words. Do not just believe them, for mere belief is impotent and could easily be misleading. Do not reject them either, out of hand, for you may be throwing away treasure. Savor them with nice discernment and swallow the morsels. Digest them patiently. Eliminate all that does not conduce to enlightenment. Assimilate all that spells light and life, wisdom and love, purity and truth. For such a consummation, I must live selflessly and desirelessly, and I must die fruitively every moment of my existential life, fully aware that there is nothing for me as a separate self, whereas there is much to shed whilst I am alive, namely, everything that belongs to the life of the worldling who is ignorant, unvirtuous, foolish, and destructive. I, the mortal, must sow good seed and tend the crop. Totality, the immortal, reaps the whole harvest. But since I am an integral part and parcel of that totality, I too will receive some good during my lifetime. After I am dead, my environment will continue to benefit till all the energy wrapped up in the little good I did is exhausted. It is somewhat like this. If I invent a useful gadget, not only I, but the whole community benefits or can benefit by its use as well as I can. That is how karma works. Samasati, which is the most powerful means for purifying me and delivering me into the holy state of Samasamadhi, is the sole means for enabling me to die fruitively. In holistic consciousness, which is the fruit of shedding all selfness and all evil, and of realizing the destruction of tanha, all of which spells the blissful serenity of desirelessness, there is the vision here now of the reality of transcendence, the self-existent, self-knowing mystery, whose silent music suffuses all solitude. And to us it brings and establishes perfect peace of mind the state of revelation. Revelation is not given from above or below. It is released from within, in which the heart wholly understands the unborn, unbecome, unmade. Thank you.